Welcome, everybody, to History Analyzed. I'm your host, Mark Palmer. This is a podcast which examines historical events and issues. The events we're analyzing today are the rise and fall of the Berlin Wall. There is no greater symbol of the Cold War than the Berlin Wall, an armed barrier which kept people imprisoned in a communist state and prevented them from traveling to a free democratic country, was the perfect image of what the Cold War was all about. So how did all this start? In World War II, the US and the UK were allies with the second worst regime in the history of mankind, Joseph Stalin's dictatorship of the USSR. America and Britain were willing to be allies with the Soviets, because the Red Army was fighting against the worst regime in history, Nazi Germany. As the old adage goes, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. When VE Day, meaning Victory in Europe Day, came in May 1945, American and British forces were in control of Italy, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, and the western and southern portions of Germany. The problem was that by VE Day, the Red Army was occupying Eastern Europe and the eastern section of Germany. In the spring of 1945, the Red Army was enormous, with millions of soldiers occupying Eastern Europe and Eastern Germany. Although Stalin had promised free elections in occupied Europe, the Soviets soon set up communist governments in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria. Europe was divided between the communist totalitarian regimes of the East and the free democratic states of the West. In a speech on March 5, 1946, at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, Winston Churchill coined the term for this separation.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Behind the Iron Curtain, the Eastern European countries were occupied by the Red Army and the Soviets were imposing their will. And the Soviet will was never good for the occupied peoples. A few countries were jointly occupied by the Soviets and the Western Allies after World War II. The occupation zones of these countries were not meant to be permanent. However, this only worked out with the occupation of Austria. Pursuant to the agreement of the Allies, the Soviets occupied the eastern part of Austria, and the Americans, British, and French occupied the rest of the country. In 1938, Austria had been annexed by Germany, and in World War II fought as part of Germany. After the war, the Allies decided to treat Austria as a separate country again. The Allied occupation lasted for 10 years. After Austria promised to be perpetually neutral, all of the occupying powers withdrew from Austria in 1955. Austria was granted full independence on May 15, 1955, and the last of the occupation troops left Austria in October of that year. The only reason the Soviets cooperated with the Western Allies to allow Austrian independence was because Joseph Stalin had died in 1953 and the new Soviet premier, Nikita Khrushchev, was trying to promote better relations with the West in 1955. The division and occupation of Korea was supposed to be for 5 years with a reunification under one government like what eventually happened in Austria. However, Korea ended up with a communist government being set up in the north and a capitalist democratic regime in the south. This resulted in two separate capitals, Pyongyang in North Korea and Seoul in South Korea. The U.S. tried to reunite Korea through elections. The elections were supposed to be for all of Korea, which would then be under one unified government. But the Korean Communists refused to participate in the elections, and the Korean Communists were being backed by the Soviets. This resulted in the permanent separation of North Korea from South Korea, which exists today. If you want to know more about Korea, you can listen to my episode entitled "The Cold War Heats Up in Korea." The most famous example of a country being divided into occupation zones is the subject of today's episode, Germany. The Soviets occupied one-third of Germany in the eastern section. The other two-thirds were split up between the U.S., Britain, and France. And if you're wondering why Germany was split up with one-third going to the Soviets and two-thirds going to the three Western allies, it's because Joseph Stalin took the position that France really did not do much to win the war. Stalin felt that the Soviet Union, America, and Britain defeated the Nazis, and those three countries were entitled to occupy Germany. Stalin basically told the US and the UK that if they wanted France to have an occupation zone in Germany, that they would have to give France parts of the British and American zones. And that's what occurred. The original plan was that Germany would be reunited as an independent country, but disputes arose regarding what type of government. Stalin insisted that Germany should be a communist country, and of course the Western allies thought that Germany should become a capitalist democracy. So how did we get two separate Germanies for 45 years? Stalin was not going to accept anything other than a communist state in his occupation zone. And the Western allies of the US, Britain, and France were not going to accept a unified Germany under communism. So, like Korea, we ended up with two countries, one free and one communist. By 1949, they became officially two separate countries. The three occupation zones by the British, French, and Americans were merged into the Federal Republic of Germany, which was commonly called West Germany, with its capital in Bonn. And the Soviet occupation zone became the Communist German Democratic Republic, which was commonly called East Germany, with its capital in East Berlin. By the way, I love how a repressive, murderous dictatorship like East Germany liked to call themselves a democratic republic. Throughout this episode, I will be referring to the communist country, the German Democratic Republic, as either East Germany or the GDR. And I will simply be referring to the free and democratic country as West Germany. This situation with two separate countries of East Germany and West Germany remained until the reunification of Germany in October 1990. A lot of people mistakenly believe that Berlin was divided because that city was on the border between East Germany and West Germany. It's not true. The German capital was located completely within East Germany. The distance from Berlin to the West Germany border was around 100 miles. So how did the US, Britain, and France get to occupy two-thirds of Berlin? When World War II was still raging and the Allies agreed to jointly occupy Germany, the Western Allies and the Soviets also agreed to jointly occupy the capital city of Berlin. You have to keep in mind that all parties thought that this was going to be a temporary situation. Stalin did not want a separate East Germany. He was hoping to have a united Germany, which would be communist. Before we talk about the border splitting Berlin, let's first talk about the inner German border. That was the term for the border created in 1945 between the Soviet occupation zone and the combined occupation zones of the US, Britain, and France. Once the two separate countries of East Germany and West Germany were officially established in 1949, the inner German border became the official border between the two Germanic countries. That border was about 850 miles long and ran from the Baltic Sea to Czechoslovakia. Until 1952, the inner German border was lightly guarded. This resulted in hundreds of thousands of people moving from East Germany to West Germany. That's why in 1952, East Germany built secure fortifications along the inner German border. Over the years, the inner German border became more and more complex. It was a series of interlocking fortifications with walls, wire fences, guard posts, landmines, and it was just incredibly deadly. The days of relatively free access between East Germany and West Germany were over, except in Berlin. There was still free movement between East Berlin and West Berlin even after 1952, when the borders between the two countries had been closed. Between 1949, when West Germany and East Germany officially became separate countries, and August 1961, when the Berlin Wall was built, approximately 2.7 million people moved from East Germany to West Germany. These people did not all pass through Berlin. A lot of people moved across the inner German border, and others moved from East Berlin into West Berlin. Some of those people who crossed through Berlin stayed in West Berlin, and some people continued from West Berlin to other parts of West Germany. In 1960 alone, approximately 200,000 people left East Germany by traveling to West Berlin. This mass exodus from East Germany to West Germany was putting the GDR on the brink of social and economic collapse. Before Germany was split into two separate nations in 1949, Joseph Stalin tried to force the Western Allies out of West Berlin. Although the official governments of West Germany and East Germany had not been established yet, the two sections of Germany were operating independently. The eastern region of Germany was still occupied by the Soviets, and the western region was occupied and controlled by the Western allies of the US, Britain, and France. To get to the western half of Berlin, which was occupied and governed by the Western allies, the US, Britain, and France were allowed to travel through approximately 100 miles from the inner German border through the Soviet occupation zone by train and by road. There were specific roads and train lines that the Western Allies were permitted to use. On June 24, 1948, Soviet forces blockaded all rail and road access to the Allied-controlled areas of West Berlin. So, if you were Harry Truman, who was president at the time, or a member of his administration, what would you do? Option number one is to use force. Force your way from the Allied occupation zone into West Berlin. But this wasn't realistic. If you used military force, the Soviets were going to respond in kind and you would have World War III. Option number two was to give in to Stalin's demand and withdraw from West Berlin. But you couldn't do that either. You couldn't abandon approximately 2 million people in West Berlin to the communist tyranny. All of America's allies throughout the world would feel betrayed and not believe that they could rely on the United States. And, considering the nature of the utterly ruthless Joseph Stalin, you would have to presume that such an action would invite more Soviet expansionism. A third option was necessary, and the Americans and the British came up with a fantastic third option, an airlift. Based upon written agreements between the Western Allies and the Soviets in 1945, there were three air corridors from West Germany to West Berlin. On June 26, 1948, only 2 days after the land access routes were closed by the Soviets, the United States launched Operation Vittles. How great of a name is that? Operation Vittles. It's a term you don't hear much anymore, but it was an archaic slang for the actual word victuals, which means food or provisions. 2 days later, Britain joined with Operation Plane Fare, spelled P-L-A-I-N-F-A-R-E. I like the pun, plane fare. Although this was intended to be a peaceful resolution to the crisis, the U.S. also sent several B-29 bombers to be stationed in the United Kingdom. The Soviets would understand the meaning of that move, since the B-29s were the bombers that carried nuclear weapons. And in case you're wondering, the answer is no. The Soviet Union did not have atomic weapons yet. The USSR first detonated an atomic bomb on August 29, 1949, a year and 2 months after the beginning of Operation Vittles. The joint operation between the US and the UK to supply West Berlin is generally known as the Berlin Airlift. This was an incredible undertaking. Not only did the Americans and British have to supply 2 million people with food, but also all the other essential supplies like coal for heating homes. At the height of the Berlin Airlift, one plane landed every 45 seconds at Tempelhof Airport in West Berlin. That is amazing. According to the U.S. Department of Defense, as well as the Associated Press, between June 1948 and May 1949, American and British pilots delivered approximately 2.3 million tons of food, coal, medicine, and other necessities on 278,000 flights into West Berlin. In one of the most heartwarming stories from the Cold War, an American pilot named Gail Halverson started tossing candy out of the window of his plane when he was coming in for a landing in West Berlin. There were kids that were watching the planes land, and Halverson was tossing candy to the kids. He encouraged other pilots to do the same. Soon, the pilots started putting little handmade parachutes onto chocolate bars and other candies and throwing them out of the windows as they were coming in for a landing. The American government knew what incredible propaganda this was and named the candy giveaway as Operation Little Vittles. Chocolate and candy donations poured in from the U.S. to be dropped to the children of West Berlin. It's estimated that approximately 21 tons of candy were dropped in about 250,000 small parachutes during the Berlin airlift. By the spring of 1949, Stalin had become convinced that the Americans and British could continue the Berlin airlift indefinitely. The success of the Berlin airlift was very embarrassing to the Soviets. As a result, on May 11, 1949, the blockade of West Berlin was lifted. Ground transportation was again allowed access to West Berlin from West Germany. The Berlin airlift was over. Joseph Stalin's power play blockading West Berlin for 11 months had an unexpected consequence. It helped convince Europeans of the necessity of NATO. NATO is an acronym which stands for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO was founded on April 4, 1949, when a dozen European and North American countries signed a treaty in Washington, D.C. On the NATO website, the following reasons are given for the formation of NATO. It is often said that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was founded in response to the threat posed by the Soviet Union. This is only partially true. In fact, the alliance's creation was part of a broader effort to serve three purposes: deterring Soviet expansionism, forbidding the revival of nationalist militarism in Europe through a strong North American presence on the continent, and encouraging European political integration. In addition to the blockade of Berlin, the other most significant event which convinced the West of the necessity for NATO was what occurred in Czechoslovakia. In February 1948, the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, with backing from their malevolent friends in Moscow, overthrew the democratically elected government and set up a communist dictatorship. NATO kept the peace in Europe throughout the Cold War and even outlasted the USSR. The Soviet Union officially dissolved on December 25, 1991, when Mikhail Gorbachev resigned his post as president of the Soviet Union, and the hammer and sickle flag was taken down from the Kremlin and replaced with the Russian tricolor flag. Unfortunately, Russia is still a menace, so NATO continues to exist. And if you're wondering about German membership in NATO, on May 6, 1955, West Germany was admitted as a NATO member, and the reunited Germany continues as a member of NATO. Fortunately for all of mankind, Joseph Stalin died on March 5, 1953. After a power struggle, Nikita Khrushchev became the new leader of the USSR. On November 10, 1958, Khrushchev delivered a speech in which he demanded that the U.S., Britain, and France pull their forces out of West Berlin within 6 months. This raised serious concerns among the Western allies. Was Khrushchev going to cut off all land access to West Berlin like Stalin had done 10 years earlier? Or was he hinting that the Soviets might physically occupy West Berlin? If the Soviets wanted, they could easily overrun the meager NATO forces in West Berlin. Of course, the United States and NATO could not accept such armed aggression. Article 5 of the NATO Treaty from 1949 provides for collective defense of all NATO members. Simply stated, an attack on one NATO member is considered an attack on all NATO members. By the way, Article 5 has only been invoked once, after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks against the U.S. Getting back to West Berlin in the late 1950s and early 1960s, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, West Germany was a NATO member as of 1955. So, an attack on West Berlin would be considered an attack on the U.S. and all of its NATO allies. This means that invasion of West Berlin could trigger World War III. And by the early 1960s, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were both armed to the teeth with hydrogen bombs, which had destructive power that dwarfed the atomic bombs which were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. This tense situation lasted until the summer of 1961. On August 13, 1961, the Western world woke up to the fact that the East Germans were walling off West Berlin. This was an incredible undertaking. West Berlin had about 2 million inhabitants and approximately 185 square miles of territory. This is an enormous enclosure. The wall which surrounded West Berlin was approximately 96 miles long. That was the total which surrounded West Berlin on all sides. The portion of the wall separating West Berlin from East Berlin was approximately 27 miles long. The remaining 69 miles of wall separated West Berlin from the surrounding East German suburbs. The East Germans started with barbed wire around all of West Berlin. Then they fortified the enclosure, which I'll get to in a few minutes. Since nobody outside of the Soviet and East German authorities knew about this plan, the civilians of East and West Berlin were completely taken by surprise. In June 1961, President Kennedy met with Soviet Premier Khrushchev in Vienna. Ever since Khrushchev's November 1958 speech demanding that the U.S. and its allies leave West Berlin, Kennedy knew that Berlin was going to be a major topic of their summit conference. At the summit in Vienna, Khrushchev was adamant that all of Berlin belonged to East Germany. Nothing was resolved at the Vienna summit, but 2 months later, the East Germans started walling off West Berlin. Because of the considerations I described earlier about the political tensions between the free world and the communist bloc and the threat of World War III breaking out, President Kennedy and his advisors were actually fairly pleased with the wall. As Kennedy said, a wall is better than a war. Now that the East Germans could prevent their citizens from escaping the communist bloc by crossing into West Berlin, tensions between East and West diminished. This meant that West Berlin was much less likely to be a possible flashpoint for World War III. Also, it was an incredible propaganda piece for the West. On June 26, 1963, almost 2 years after the wall was built, President Kennedy gave a speech in West Berlin. Contrary to popular belief, the speech was not delivered next to the Berlin Wall, but nearby. Kennedy was actually located in a square in front of the West Berlin City Hall. At the time, the square was known as Rudolf Wilder Platz. That square is now known as John F. Kennedy Platz. Here are a few memorable parts from that speech.
There are many people in the world who really don't understand, or say they don't, what is the great issue between the free world and the communist world. Let them come to Berlin. Freedom has many difficulties, and democracy is not perfect. But we have never had to put a wall up to keep our people in, to prevent them from leaving us. Freedom is indivisible. And when one man is enslaved, all are not free. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
As I said a little while earlier, when they started the Berlin Wall on August 13, 1961, the East Germans first used barbed wire. Shortly thereafter, the barbed wire was replaced by a wall of concrete. During the remainder of 1961, the wall grew in size and complexity. Over the years, the Berlin Wall was reconfigured several times and was no longer just a wall, but a giant border strip surrounding West Berlin. All of the structures that were collectively called the Berlin Wall were on the East German side of the border. None of the Berlin Wall was in West Berlin. By 1989, the last year of the Berlin Wall, this symbol of oppression consisted of the following components. There was an inner wall. This was the closest structure to the people in East Berlin. This was not that impressive of a structure, but it was the warning to people that they could not go any further. On the far side, there was the outer wall. This is what faced the people of West Berlin. It was about 12 feet tall and almost 4 feet wide and made of reinforced concrete. The reason for the reinforced concrete was to prevent somebody from crashing through the wall with a vehicle. The outer wall had a rounded top so people could not get a grip if they were trying to climb over. In between the inner wall and the outer wall, there were a lot of barriers to stop anybody from escaping. There were electrified fences, there were alarms, there were floodlights to make sure anybody would be seen, there were spikes and tank traps in case somebody tried to bulldoze their way through with some kind of armored vehicle. There were guard towers, and of course the guards had machine guns with shoot-to-kill orders. There were also guards on foot with attack dogs, as well as machine guns. There were landmines. It was a true death strip. When a city of approximately 3 million people became divided between two hostile governments, there were a lot of practical problems with the infrastructure. One example was the subway system. Berlin had a pretty extensive subway system when the city was completely split in 1961. Before August 13, 1961, people could travel freely between West Berlin and East Berlin, and this included riding the subways between the two halves of the city. But when the East Germans built the wall completely surrounding West Berlin, they also separated the subways between the two sections of the city. Some of the subway lines only ran in West Berlin or only ran in East Berlin, so there were no problems. Some of the subway lines, which started in West Berlin, ended in East Berlin, those were severed and run as separate lines. But there were two subway lines which started and ended in West Berlin, but passed through a portion of East Berlin. The East German authorities allowed those subway lines to operate, but the subways could not stop at the East Berlin stations. The subway stations on those two lines, which were located in East Berlin, were closed, and nobody was allowed into those stations, and the subway trains were not allowed to stop at those East Berlin stations. Those closed subway stops in East Berlin were known as ghost stations. Think about riding on one of those subways. You get on at a stop in West Berlin, and you're going to another stop in West Berlin, but during the ride, you pass through what is essentially enemy territory, and you see these subway stations that are deserted and the trains are not allowed to stop. It had to be very eerie. And if you're wondering why the East German government allowed West Berlin subways to pass through East Berlin, as is usually the case, the answer was money. The West German government paid the East German government money to allow those two subway lines to run through East Berlin. Besides the subway, there was a lot of infrastructure that had to be shared throughout Berlin. Electricity, water, sewers, gas had all been shared. Problems arose when Stalin blockaded West Berlin from June 1948 through May 1949, which I described earlier. During the blockade, West Berlin had difficulty with its utilities. Because of the blockade, West Berlin authorities developed their own electrical, water, and gas systems. East Germany was willing to take the sewage from West Berlin because the sewage water was processed into fertilizer utilized by East Germany. What was the human cost of the Berlin Wall? According to current German sources, it is estimated that between 1961 and 1989, over 100,000 East Germans tried to escape to West Germany. Not all were at the Berlin Wall. Some were at the border between the two countries, known as the Inner German Border, which I described earlier. More than 600 East Germans were shot and killed by GDR border guards or died in some other manner during their escape attempts to West Germany. And of that figure, at least 140 people died at the Berlin Wall. On a more positive note, it's estimated that between 1961 and 1989, approximately 5,000 people made successful escapes to West Berlin. East Germans escaped to West Berlin in a variety of ways. Here are some famous examples. One of the most famous escapes was by Conrad Schumann. On August 15, 1961, only 2 days after the barbed wire was first laid down to separate East Berlin from West Berlin, 19-year-old Conrad Schumann became a symbol of all of those seeking freedom when he was photographed leaping over a tangle of barbed wire into West Berlin. A photographer just happened to be there and captured the scene on video. Then a still photograph was taken from the video. The photograph was distributed to the Associated Press and appeared on the front pages of newspapers around the world. What made the photograph so remarkable was that Conrad Schumann was an East German soldier and was wearing his uniform when he leapt over the barbed wire. You've probably seen this photo. Schumann did not stay in West Berlin. He moved to the southern German state of Bavaria, where he married and had a son. The story has a tragic ending. In June 1998, Schumann hanged himself from a tree in his backyard. There was no note, and the motive for the suicide is not known. Less than 4 months after the Berlin Wall was started, a young railroad engineer in East Berlin named Harry Detterling noticed that an unused train track still ran from an East Berlin suburb into West Berlin under the wall. On the night of December 5, 1961, Harry Detterling and his fireman, Harmut Litschi, along with approximately 25 friends and family members, crashed a train through the Berlin Wall and escaped to West Berlin. The next day, East Germans towed the train back to their side of the wall and tore up the railroad tracks and rebuilt that section of the wall. An incredible series of escapes involved the three Bethke brothers, Ingo, Holger, and Egbert. I know I'm probably mispronouncing these names. My apologies. The first to escape was Ingo. In 1975, he was an East German border guard and discovered a way to get to the banks of the Elbe River. That river does not go through Berlin. Ingo and a friend used an air mattress and silently paddled down the river until they reached West Germany. The next brother to escape was Holger. 8 years after Ingo escaped, Holger arranged for one of the most daring escapes. Holger had become very proficient in archery. In May 1983, Holger went to a tall building in East Berlin, which overlooked the wall. He shot an arrow with a wire cable attached into West Berlin, where his brother Ingo was waiting. Ingo secured the wire cable to his car on the West Berlin side, and Holger secured the wire cable to the building on the East Berlin side. He then used a metal pulley to ride over the wall like a zip line. How cool is that? That was two brothers down and one to go. In May 1989, Ingo and Holger used two ultralight aircraft to rescue their brother, Egbert. These ultralight aircraft look like hang gliders with an engine and a place for passengers to hang below the wings. The two aircraft took off from a sports field in West Berlin and flew over the wall into East Berlin. One of the aircraft landed at the East Berlin Soviet War Memorial and picked up Egbert. The other aircraft circled overhead. The reason they had two ultralight aircraft was in case there was a problem with one of them. The two aircraft flew back to West Berlin and landed safely in front of the Reichstag, that was the German parliament building. All three of the brothers had now escaped from East Germany. In 1979, an aircraft mechanic named Hans-Peter Strelzik and his friend Günter Wetzel built a hot air balloon. They built a cast iron platform with posts at the corners for handholds and rope anchors. Four propane cooking gas cylinders were fastened to the center. Their wives stitched together bed sheets and pieces of canvas to make the balloon, which was approximately 70 feet in diameter. In September 1979, the two couples, along with their combined four children, flew in the hot air balloon over the wall into West Germany near the Bavarian town of Nyla. The balloon soared approximately 8,000 feet above the ground. The entire flight took around 30 minutes. A straightforward escape occurred in December 1962 by a trapeze artist named Horst Klein. He discovered that there was an electrical cable that crossed over the wall but was not being utilized anymore. Since there was no electricity running through the cable, Horst Klein used the cable to pull himself along the cable over the wall and landed in West Berlin. The story has a bad ending. Klein received several letters from his wife, who was still in East Berlin, saying that she could not go on living without him. She had been pressured by the East German authorities to send these letters. Unfortunately, Klein returned to East Berlin in late 1963 and was immediately arrested. He was sentenced to 30 months of hard labor. And here's the worst part. Within a few months after he returned, his wife divorced him and married another man. It's estimated that around 300 East Germans escaped under the Berlin Wall by digging tunnels. It usually took months to build a viable tunnel, and the tunnels were often discovered by the Stasi, the East German secret police, before they could be utilized. The most successful tunnel occurred in 1964 when 57 people escaped through a tunnel into West Berlin. Because of the number of people who got through, that tunnel has now become known as Tunnel 57. A young guy named Joachim Neumann had escaped East Germany in 1961 by using a fake Swiss passport. But he left behind all of his relatives and his longtime girlfriend. He wanted to get his relatives and his girlfriend out of East Germany. Joachim Neumann and several of his friends used an abandoned bakery on the West Berlin side of the wall as a starting point. They dug down about 12 meters and underneath the wall for more than 100 meters. And for those of us who are not familiar with the metric system, a meter is just over 1 yard. The digging took 5 months. The tunnel was ready on October 3, 1964. Neumann and his friends had contacted their relatives and close friends in East Berlin and told them to come to the building on the Strelitzerstrasse, where the East Berlin entrance to the tunnel was located. Over the course of 2 days on October 3 and October 4, 1964, they were able to get 57 people through the tunnel before it was discovered by border guards. One of the people that escaped through the tunnel was Joachim Neumann's girlfriend, Christa Grula, and they were married in West Germany. There were certain places where people with the right authorization could pass from east to west. These were called checkpoints. There were three such checkpoints between East Germany and West Germany, checkpoints A, B, and C. In military parlance, they were known as Checkpoint Alpha, Checkpoint Bravo, and Checkpoint Charlie. Checkpoint Alpha was on the border between East Germany and West Germany, but not in Berlin. Checkpoint Bravo was located between West Berlin and one of the East German suburbs. But Checkpoint Charlie was located right in the middle of the city between East Berlin and West Berlin and became the most famous border crossing of the Cold War. Checkpoint Charlie is now a tourist spot and a memorial site. I've been there and it is very moving. I would highly recommend a visit. On June 12, 1987, U.S. President Ronald Reagan gave a speech in front of the Berlin Wall challenging Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev to live up to his professed ideals of liberalization for the communist bloc. Here's the most memorable part of that speech.
Behind me stands a wall that encircles the free sectors of this city, part of a vast system of barriers that divides the entire continent of Europe. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
No one imagined that less than 2.5 years later, the Berlin Wall would actually fall. So how did this incredible structure ever come to an end? I cannot get into the entire end of the Cold War in this episode because it is a very long and detailed story. But the main point that applies here is that Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev reversed a long-standing policy of the USSR to militarily back the communist governments of Eastern Europe. Authoritarian communist regimes would continue throughout Eastern Europe as long as the Soviets were willing to brutally crush any democratic uprisings. The USSR sent in the tanks to put down calls for any loosening of the iron grip of the communist parties several times. In June 1953, they sent the tanks into East Berlin. In 1956, they did the same in Hungary. And in 1968, Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia. In the late 1980s, Gorbachev told the Eastern European satellite states that they would have to stand on their own. The Soviets were not going to back them militarily. As a result, the communist governments in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and East Germany all fell. The collapse of the East German communist regime occurred suddenly on the night of November 9, 1989. In response to protests by the citizens of East Germany, an East Berlin party official named Günter Schabowski announced at a press conference upcoming travel reforms which were going to allow citizens of the GDR to travel more freely to West Berlin. When questioned at the press conference when this policy would go into effect, Günter Schabowski said, immediately. He meant that the program of applying for visits to West Germany would start right away. But people mistakenly thought that the border between East Berlin and West Berlin was immediately open. Thousands of people flocked to Checkpoint Charlie and demanded to enter West Berlin. The East German guards did not know what to do and eventually simply stepped aside and let the people cross into West Berlin. Thousands of West Berliners arrived at the other side of Checkpoint Charlie and other points of the wall. People started climbing onto the wall. Others took sledgehammers or any other tools they could find to try to knock pieces out of this horrible symbol of oppression. The Berlin Wall was now open. 11 months later, The Unification Treaty went into effect, and as of October 3, 1990, Germany was reunited as one country and as a democracy, with its capital in a reunited Berlin. There's very little left of the Berlin Wall today. Small sections have been kept in parts of the city as relics of those tragic times. In 1989 and 1990, when the Berlin Wall was being dismantled, there were bits of it all over the ground. Since this rubble was just going to be disposed of by the government officials, people were allowed to take pieces of the wall as poignant reminders of the horrors of the communist regime. In 1990, a friend of mine went to Berlin. His wife was originally from Germany. My buddy brought me back a piece of the Berlin Wall. I keep it on my desk to this day. It's a great reminder of both tyranny and the eventual triumph of people yearning to be free. That's it for today. Please tell your friends, relatives, and coworkers about History Analyzed. Word of mouth is the best way to increase the audience for this podcast. Please subscribe to this podcast, and please like this and my other episodes. If you're listening on a podcast app like Spotify or Apple, which allow for ratings, I'd greatly appreciate a 5-star rating. Some apps allow for reviews, and I'd also appreciate a kind review. Check out my website, historyanalyzed.com, where you will find links to my podcast episodes, as well as fun items for history geeks. Thank you for listening. Catch you next episode.